Authentic Tibetan Teachings and Transcripts from bodhiarchive.org.
Imagine, if you will, just looking at a map of a barren, really unforgiving desert.
Mm-hmm.
You're tracing your finger over the shifting dunes of the Taklamakan, just studying that harsh topography. And then someone tells you that beneath all those sands lies a kingdom built entirely on the psychic vibrations of an awakened mind.
Yeah, it's quite a shift in perspective.
It really is. So today, we aren't just looking at geography. We're looking at how a Buddha literally terraforms the earth. So welcome to this special Dharma teaching.
Thank you. And we really want to invite you, the listener, to truly settle in as you listen today.
Right.
Allow your mind to relax, maybe become a bit more spacious.
Yeah.
You know, consciously slow your breath. We are going to be taking our time today to explore a really profound canonical Buddhist text.
Exactly. Because the teachings we're unpacking today, they require a kind of measured reverence. We're speaking to you today, not merely as analysts, but really as fellow practitioners exploring the vast implications of the Buddha's words.
Yeah, and the text that's guiding our practice today is called the Noble Great Vehicle Sutra, the Prophecy on Mount Gosho.
Oh, such a beautiful title.
It is. And within the Tibetan Buddhist canon, specifically the Dzogchen Kagyur, this is cataloged as To 357. We're going to be studying the English translation provided by the scholars at 84,000. That's translating the words of the Buddha.
Right, which is such an incredible initiative.
Completely. Yeah. Their mission to translate the entirety of the Buddha's words into modern languages is, well, it's not just some academic exercise. It is a vital transmission of the lineage.
Yeah.
It ensures that these profound methods for awakening just, they remain accessible to all of us.
So to properly orient ourselves for this deep dive into the source material, we need to understand the physical space the sutra is actually concerned with, right?
Mm.
We're focusing on a region known historically as the Kingdom of Khotan, or Li Yul in Tibetan.
Right, the Li country.
Exactly. And on a contemporary map, if you were to look today, this is the Hotan region in China's Xinjiang province. It sits as this oasis right on the southwest edge of the Taklamakan Desert.
Which was incredibly strategic.
Yeah, it served as a really critical node on the southern branch of the ancient Silk Route.
And Khotan's geographical reality really made it one of the most important cultural crossroads of the ancient world. It was nestled right north of the Kunlun mountain range.
Right.
And it functioned as this major outpost of Indian culture, stretching all the way back to the era of Emperor Ashoka.
Wow, that far back.
Oh, absolutely. Throughout the entire first millennium, Khotan was, it was the precise crucible where Chinese merchants, traveling monastics, and scholars directly encountered Indian Mahayana texts and doctrines.
So it was like a melting pot for the Dharma.
Exactly. It was the primary artery pumping the Dharma into East Asia. And, you know, it held immense spiritual significance for early Tibetan Buddhists, too. They looked at Khotan as this absolute bastion of pure practice.
But I think, and this is so important for you listening, reading this text purely as a historical document, well, it misses the point entirely.
Oh, completely.
Because the sutra falls into a specific, really fascinating subgenre called prophetic histories, or prophecies of decline.
Right, which is quite different from what we usually think of.
Yeah, because when practitioners usually encounter the word prophecy in a Mahayana context, like, say, in the Lotus Sutra, it typically refers to the Buddha predicting the future awakening of a specific disciple. You know,
mm-hmm. He tells a practitioner exactly when, where, and under what name they're going to achieve perfect Buddhahood.
Right. But this text, it operates on a completely different scale.
It really expands the lens from the individual to an entire civilization. The sutra explores the life cycle of a landscape itself.
It's so fascinating.
It asks how the Dharma physically takes root in the dirt and the stone of a region. What specific conditions are required to actually sustain a society that's based on liberation? And how does a spiritually oriented kingdom navigate the inevitable vulnerabilities of historical and political upheaval? It maps out the absolute interdependence of a nation's external prosperity and its internal virtue.
So you can really view this text as a spiritual time capsule. It's mapping both the literal geography of a nation, but also, and this is key for our practice, the internal geography of a practitioner's mind.
Exactly. It's a mirror.
Yeah, it provides a blueprint for how raw, chaotic potential is ultimately shaped into a stable foundation for liberation. So let's get into the narrative. It opens with the Buddha Shakyamuni residing in Rajaka down in India.
Mm-hmm.
And he has this premonition regarding a future land in the north that will come to be known as the Land of Virtue.
Mm-hmm.
So acting on this, he literally rises into the sky to undertake this miraculous journey.
And the scale of this journey, it's explicitly meant to overwhelm the ordinary conceptual mind.
Right. It's not a subtle trip.
No, not at all. The Buddha is accompanied by just a staggering retinue. He's traveling with immense assemblies of bodhisattvas alongside hearers, the dedicated disciples of the foundational vehicle, and just an unfathomable array of worldly and celestial gods.
The auditory and visual components of this journey are so highly specific, too. The text says Panishika, the king of the Gandharvas, is playing this divine music.
Yes.
And the Kinnara king, Delightful, is literally raining down offerings. It is a symphony of awakened activity moving all across the sky toward Khotan.
But, and this is where it gets really interesting. The moment of arrival totally subverts all expectations.
Yeah, it really does.
When this luminous procession finally looks down upon the designated region of Khotan, there is no city. There are no people.
Nothing at all.
Nothing. There is only a vast, unformed, ocean-like lake.
So the Buddha descends to a hill bordering this massive, watery expanse. It's called Mount Goga.
Right. And the Sanskrit term Gosheka actually translates to cow horn.
Cow horn, okay.
Yeah, it's a name derived from the hill's two distinct pointed peaks.
Got it. So standing upon this peak, looking north over the water, the Buddha engages in a deliberate, world-altering spiritual action. The text states that he immerses himself in billions of meditative absorptions.
Billions.
Billions. Utilizing the specific meditative states that are unique to a fully awakened being. And from the depth of this realization, he blesses the environment.
Mm-hmm.
The scope of this blessing encompasses everything, right? From the golden base of the earth all the way up to the absolute peak of existence.
I think we really need to pause and dissect the mechanics of a blessing here.
Yes, please. Because for a modern listener, a blessing often sounds like, I don't know, a polite wish or a simple prayer for good fortune.
Right, like bless you when someone sneezes.
Exactly. But in the context of Mahayana metaphysics, an adhisthana, which is the Sanskrit term for blessing, is a massive assertion of spiritual power. It alters the fundamental frequency of reality itself.
That's a great way to put it. The sutra specifically states that through this blessing, the Buddha grants the space protection. He purifies it, establishes auspiciousness, and crucially secures its boundaries.
Let's talk about that, securing the boundaries.
It's the critical first step, because before profound realization can be sustained in a physical location, the space has to be delineated. It has to be sealed off from a relentless, chaotic proliferation of ordinary sasya.
Okay, so he's essentially creating a safe, energetic container.
Precisely. He is imprinting the environment with the resonance of awakening well before a single human being even arrives to build a home or plant a field.
And he doesn't actually hold this responsibility alone, does he?
No, he doesn't. He instructs the vast assembly of bodhisattvas to add their own blessings. This ensures that future practitioners in this space will swiftly attain meditative absorption.
And this is where we witness the really intricate drafting of a spiritual blueprint. The great bodhisattvas step forward, and they bless the precise geographical plots where future temples will eventually stand.
And the correlation between the specific bodhisattvas and the temples they bless offers such deep insight into the Buddhist path.
Walk us through some of those.
Well, take the bodhisattva Akashagarbha, whose name means the nucleus of space. He specifically blesses the site for a future temple called Relinquishing the Personality.
The symbolism there is just brilliant.
Right.
Because space is infinite. It has no center. It has no boundaries. And the human personality, the ego, is the exact opposite of that.
Completely.
It is the obsessive fixation on a center. So invoking the bodhisattva of boundless space to bless a physical temple dedicated to dismantling ego clinging, I mean, it's a perfect matching of spiritual technology to the landscape.
It really is. And the other pairings in the text follow this exact same deep logic. Noble Avalokiteshvara, who is the pure embodiment of great compassion, blesses the ground for the radiant temple.
Ah, because compassion is the radiant warmth of the awakened mind.
Exactly. And then you have Manjushri Kumarakuta, the embodiment of supreme wisdom. He blesses the ground for a temple called Relinquishing.
Right, because you cannot fully relinquish attachment without the sharp sword of Manjushri's wisdom to actually sever the root of ignorance.
You need that wisdom.
Mm-hmm.
We also see Maitreya blessing the site where he will personally reside.
Huh.
Kaitagarbha blesses Wisdom Mountain. Vajiraja, the medicine king, consecrates a temple for accomplishing spiritual attainments.
Wow.
And Samantabhadra blesses a temple specifically for sustaining the saga. They're literally embedding the entire curriculum of the Mahayana path into the mud beneath the lake.
Into the mud. And as they finish laying this energetic groundwork, this profound visual manifestation occurs, right?
Mm.
The assembled bodhisattvas project intense light rays, and it illuminates the dark waters of the vast lake. And from the depths, exactly 353 lotuses break the surface of the water.
It's such a striking image.
And inside each lotus sits the glowing, luminous body of a Buddha or a bodhisattva.
So when the gods ask what this incredible display means, the Buddha explains that the 353 lotuses portend the exact number of hermitages, temples, and monastic centers that will eventually flourish in this land.
So the spiritual architecture is essentially complete at this point.
It is.
But for me, the presence of the lake still remains the most compelling mystery of this opening scene.
How so?
Well, why must the genesis of this great Dharma kingdom begin with an uninhabitable body of water? I mean, if the goal is a thriving human society, why not just bless a populated area? Why start with water?
It's a great question. Water, across so many Buddhist origin narratives, represents pure, unconditioned potential. It lacks any fixed form.
Right.
Think about it. A pre-existing human settlement brings with it established karmic patterns.
Oh, sure. Entrenched violence, territorial disputes, rigid social hierarchy.
Exactly. If you attempt to build a pure Dharma realm on top of deeply ingrained, afflicted human infrastructure, the karmic noise is just too loud. The blessing would really struggle to take root.
So the lake acts as a kind of insulator.
Yes. The unformed water can perfectly hold the vibrational imprint of the Buddhas without any resistance from human ignorance.
Okay, that makes so much sense. So the spiritual architecture, those 353 lotuses, must be fully established in the realm of pure potential first. The environment is energetically prepared so that when humans finally do arrive, the land itself supports their practice.
That's it, exactly. And that transition from pure potential to human reality is what the gods ask about next. They want to know, well, when will the physical land appear? And who is actually going to found this civilization?
Right. And in response, the Buddha delivers a highly specific prophecy regarding the genesis of the land of virtue.
Mm.
He states that exactly 100 years after his own passing into Parinirvana, the human history of Khotan will begin with a Chinese king named Kaiyang.
And King Kaiyang is described in the text as having 1,000 sons. He tasks them with seeking out virgin lands to cultivate and settle. Eventually, the king learns of Mount Gusdyuga and this uniquely blessed land out in the west.
Naturally, he wants it.
He desires to claim it, yes. But he requires an heir specifically suited for this monumental task. So he prays to Vaishravana, the divine king and great guardian deity of the northern direction, asking for a son.
And Vaishravani answers, but through a miraculous intervention rather than a biological one,
mm-hmm.
he grants the Chinese king a son who actually belongs to the great Indian Dharma King Ashoka. And the infant survival is secured when this miraculous breast emerges directly from the soil to nurse him.
It's incredible.
This extraordinary event earns the boy the title Suckler of the Earth Breast.
We really need to look at the symbolism here because it's vital. The earth itself, the very landscape that has just been saturated with the blessings of the Buddhas, is physically nourishing the future ruler.
Wow. So his mandate to rule is literally drawn from the blessed soil.
Exactly. And historically and linguistically, this figure actually aligns with names found in real Khotanese records, such as Kustana or Gustana, which directly reference this exact mythos of the earth breast.
That's fascinating. So the Chinese king Kaiyang raises the boy, equipping him with royal authority, wealth, and this huge entourage of ministers, prominently featuring a senior Chinese minister named Zhang Shou.
Right.
And when Prince Suckler of the Earth Breast comes of age, he journeys west to cultivate this newly revealed land, establishing a kingdom initially named after himself.
Now, notice the deliberate sociological merging that's occurring in the prophecy here. The text emphasizes that significant populations from India will also travel east to become subjects of this newly established kingdom.
Right. It's not just one group.
No. Minister Zhang Shou is explicitly tasked with founding villages that integrate both Chinese and Indian peoples. Khotan is prophesied to be a synthesis, a literal bridge connecting two monumental cultures under the unified umbrella of Dharma governance.
And the Buddha describes a future lineage of Khotanese kings who will just be intensely devoted. Mm. They'll construct the 353 prophesied hermitages, they'll engineer irrigation systems, and actively support practitioners.
Some of these monarchs will even abdicate to become monastics themselves.
Which is huge. So the society will be defined by its constant accumulation of merit, relying entirely upon the three jewels, the Buddha, the Dharma, and the Sangha.
And this brings us to the central thesis of the sutra regarding political and social stability. The text argues that a nation's material prosperity is completely, inextricably tied to its spiritual devotion.
Let's talk about how that works mechanically.
To grasp that, we really have to explore the most critical architectural and spiritual feature of the text, which is the stupa.
Okay, so for those unfamiliar, a stupa is essentially a sacred monument. In its physical form, it often houses relics of awakened beings. But structurally and spiritually, it's a three-dimensional mandala.
Right.
It represents the fully awakened mind of the Buddha, containing very specific geometric representations of the path to enlightenment. And in this prophecy, the fate of the entire kingdom is anchored to the future Gomasalaganda stupa, which will be built on the bank of the river Goma.
The Buddha establishes a terrifyingly clear causal link here between the stupa and the survival of the state.
Yes. Let me quote him directly. He says, "Thus, for as long as that stupa called on the bank of river Goma, as well as Kajapa stupa, flourish and are sites of worship, the land of virtue will also flourish and prosper. Whenever these two stupas fall into decline, this land will also fall into decline and become empty."
That is just a staggering redefinition of infrastructure.
It really is. Normally, we measure a civilization's stability by its agriculture, right? Or its military strength, or its economic output.
Exactly. But the Buddha is asserting that the load-bearing pillars of Khotan survival are its monuments of virtue. The stupas act as a physical barometer for the nation's collective karma.
So if the citizens abandon their practice, if reverence decays and the stupas crumble, the merit that literally holds the physical reality of the kingdom together evaporates.
The prosperity vanishes and the land just empties. It forces you as a practitioner to ask what actually sustains your reality. Mm. If you believe your security comes solely from your bank account or, I don't know, your political affiliations, this text challenges that entirely. Your ultimate security is your accumulated merit.
However, because Khotan exists within Sasara, the realm of conditioned, suffering existence, its accumulated merit will inevitably be tested.
Oh, for sure. The Buddha does not prophesize a utopian eternity. He foresees tremendous conflict.
He looks into the future and sees armies mobilizing against this prosperous oasis. He specifically names the forces of Sumpa, the Drugu or Tibetan clans, and armies from Hor and China.
Right, because the sheer wealth and strategic importance of Khotan just make it a massive target for aggression.
So anticipating this, the Buddha formally conscripts the worldly gods in his retinue, including Vaishravan, Ajita, and various Naga kings, entrusting them with the protection of the land, the stupas, and the practitioners.
But, and this is a big but, worldly protectors in Buddhist cosmology operate under strict laws of interdependence. They're not omnipotent creators who could just magically wave away invading armies on a whim. When these gods accept the responsibility to protect Khotan, they invoke a really rigid if-then clause. They swear to defend the kingdom only as long as the human rulers govern in accordance with the Dharma.
The gods are incredibly specific about the terms of their contract, too. They state that if a Khotanese king begins to protect criminals, if he disrespects the monastic community, or if he lusts after the wealth belonging to the three jewels, the gods will withdraw their protection.
Mm-hmm.
They actually explain that their own splendor and might are directly fueled by the roots of virtue generated by the human population.
This is such a vital point of Buddhist theology. Worldly protectors function somewhat like a battery.
Oh, I like that analogy.
The human beings generate the electricity, the merit through their ethical conduct, their meditation, their offerings. The protectors absorb that merit and then use it to forcefully repel obstacles.
So if the humans stop practicing, the battery just drains.
Exactly. The gods literally lose the power to intervene, no matter how much they might want to.
And if the human rulers become actively corrupt, the gods actually vow to turn against them,
promising to expel deceitful kings to inferior lands.
Yes. Conversely, if the kingdom remains virtuous and is attacked by foreign armies, the gods promise to intervene decisively.
How so?
They vow to incite discord within the invading troops, causing them to experience infighting and perish without Khotan ever having to actually engage in warfare.
Now, some might find the idea of guides inciting deadly infighting contradictory to Buddhist nonviolence.
Sure, that's a common reaction. But within this framework, the gods are just facilitating the rapid ripening of the invading army's own negative karma, right?
Exactly. The protective shield of a perfectly virtuous Khotan acts like a mirror. The aggression of the invaders just reflects right back upon themselves, destroying them through their own hostility before they can desecrate the sacred center.
And to fortify this defensive perimeter, the Buddha also prophesies the emergence of sacred images, consecrated statues of the Buddhas that will act as actual sentinels at the borders. An image of the source of bliss will manifest at Koshay Castle. An image called Shinaja will guard the north, Keelung the east, and an image called Abiding in the Royal Palace will defend Virtuous Castle.
And the most prominent among these is the cast image of the Vesgon Dupaka, destined for the Dinadziya Temple. The text actually highlights this as the first cast image created in Jambuvipa, our world system.
Oh.
It serves as the master template for all subsequent images in the region.
So for a practitioner raised in traditions wary of idolatry, how do we understand the role of these statues? Because they aren't just decorative art. The Buddha says they will actively guard the teachings.
Well, in the Mahayana view, a properly consecrated image is not just a symbol of the Buddha. It is a manifestation of the Buddha's presence.
Okay, explain that a bit more.
When an image is cast, filled with relics, and consecrated by realized masters, it becomes saturated with the living energy of awakening. The Buddha states that if practitioners approach these statues with genuine faith, the energetic transmission, the blessing they receive, is identical to encountering the living Buddha in person.
So the statues anchor the enlightened frequency to the physical grid of the nation.
Precisely. All of this immense infrastructure, the oaths of the protectors, the miraculous statues, the towering stupas, it all exists for one singular purpose.
Which is?
To maintain a secure environment where human beings can practice the Dharma safely.
And regarding that practice, the sutra delivers a teaching on merit that really demands careful examination.
It does.
Because the Buddha unequivocally states that the absolute pinnacle of merit is the act of going forth, meaning renouncing the world to become a fully ordained monastic.
The language he uses is, it's quite uncompromising. It highlights a massive disparity in the generation of merit between a householder and a renunciate.
Yeah, I think we really need to look at this closely, as many people listening are dedicated lay practitioners.
Absolutely.
Because the Buddha claims that a layperson could gather roots of virtue, practicing generosity and ethics every single day for 100 years, and yet the merit generated would not equal a fraction of 1% of the merit generated by someone who goes forth into homelessness and abides by the teachings for just a single day.
It's a stark comparison.
It is. Does this render lay practice spiritually insignificant?
I mean, it is entirely understandable why it might read that way initially. However, we have to synthesize this statement with the rest of the sutra.
Right, we have to look at the whole picture.
The text extensively praises the lay patrons, the kings, the ministers, the merchants who construct the 353 temples and ensure the actual physical survival of the community.
And the gods vow to protect those lay people just as fiercely as the monastics.
Exactly. The land of virtue is a symbiotic ecosystem.
So the monastic community is the blossom. The lay community is the root system and the soil. Yeah. You cannot have one without the other.
Precisely. The Buddha is not condemning lay life. What he is doing is scientifically quantifying the energetic weight of complete renunciation.
Okay, unpack that energetic weight for us.
To go forth is to willingly sever every single tie to cessoric security. You give up the pursuit of wealth, the comfort of family, the protection of social status, and really the illusion of control.
Yeah.
The sheer psychological and spiritual force required to step completely out of the stream of ordinary worldly attachment. It generates a magnitude of merit that simply cannot be replicated by someone who is still holding on to a mortgage, a career, and a familial legacy.
And the Buddha points to his own biography as the ultimate proof of this principle, right?
Yes, he does.
He recounts how, after completing the necessary professions over countless lifetimes, he finally achieved perfect awakening only after he made the physical break from his royal life.
Mm-hmm.
He describes leaving his father's compound at midnight, retreating to the forest, cutting his hair, and trading his priceless garments for the simple saffron robes of a hunter.
The physical renunciation of the world was the necessary prerequisite for the total internal renunciation of the ego.
So, for those of us practicing in a lay context, This teaching is not meant to induce guilt.
Not at all. It is an invitation to radically examine our internal relationship to our attachments. Even if we remain householders, we can cultivate the mind of renunciation.
Oh, that's beautiful, the mind of renunciation.
We can practice recognizing that our homes, our jobs, and our relationships, while deeply meaningful, are ultimately transient. We gather our worldly merit, but we do so understanding that it is a stepping stone toward the ultimate liberation of letting go completely.
This profound accumulation of merit, the stabilizing power of the stupas, and the fierce protection of the gods, they all set the stage for what I consider the most cinematic and philosophically rich sequence in the entire sutra.
It's an incredible section.
Having laid out the future history of the kingdom, the Buddha performs a miracle that weaves the ultimate truth directly into the environment itself.
This is the miracle of the divine flowers. It is the exact moment the landscape itself becomes a living Dharma teaching.
So let's picture this. Seated on Mount Guyuga, the Buddha emits light rays utterly infused with great compassion. These rays shoot outward and plunge deep into the vast dark waters of the lake.
Mm-hmm.
The text describes how this light interacts with the aquatic life, the fish, the insects, the submerged creatures. The light instantly quells their suffering, extinguishes their fear and anger, and replaces it with profound loving kindness.
It plants the immutable seed of awakening in their consciousness, which guarantees their future rebirths as humans or gods.
We see here that the compassion of a Buddha is an active transformative force. It physically rewrites the karmic trajectories of sentient beings.
It's not just a nice thought.
No, but the light doesn't stop in the water. It reemerges, mingling with the light from the 353 luminous lotuses and the assembled bodhisattvas, and it explodes upward into the atmosphere, totally blanketing the sky.
And from this canopy of light, a miraculous rain of divine flowers begins to fall over the entire region.
As these divine blossoms drift down, they brush against one another in the air, but instead of the soft rustle of petals, their collision produces resonant, articulate sounds.
It's wild to imagine.
The flowers ring out, literally speaking, the gateways of Dharma. The empty sky over the lake becomes a symphony of philosophical truth.
And the sutra catalogs the specific teachings ringing from the flowers.
Yeah.
And it basically reads as a masterclass in Mahayana philosophy.
So let's analyze the exact concepts the flowers are broadcasting into the environment, starting with the most foundational, dependent origination.
Right.
For a practitioner trying to deepen their understanding, what exactly is the landscape singing when it sings of dependent origination?
Well, dependent origination, which is Pratyajasamutpada in Sanskrit, is the insight that completely shatters the illusion of independent existence. The flowers are declaring that nothing in the universe exists in isolation. Every thought you have, every cell in your body, the mountain you stand on, and the kingdom you build, they only exist because a vast, infinite web of causes and conditions came together to produce them.
So because everything is dependent on something else, nothing possesses a permanent, isolated self.
Exactly. The environment is literally being tuned to the frequency of interconnectedness.
And the flowers also explicitly ring out teachings on the five aggregates, or the skandhas.
Yes, they do.
They declare, and I quote, "Within the five aggregates, there is no sentient being, nor any soul, person, or life force." That is a direct assault on our most deeply held assumption about who we actually are.
It is the ultimate deconstruction.
Mm-hmm.
The Buddha taught that what we call a self is actually just five shifting aggregates of experience.
Physical form, feelings, perceptions, mental formations, and consciousness.
Right. We instinctively bundle these five transient processes together, and we slap a label on it that says, me. We defend this me. We enrich it. We fear its death.
Of course we do.
But the flowers are singing the truth of anatomical spiritual reality. If you pull the aggregates apart and look closely, you will not find a soul. You will not find a permanent person. You will only find a river of causes and conditions.
This philosophical symphony, it culminates in the teaching of the limit of reality, pointing to the ultimate unborn and unproduced nature of all phenomena.
Hmm.
The sutra provides a poetic, really devastatingly beautiful translation of the ultimate truth spoken by the colliding flowers. It says, "The delusion of the five types of beings is like a dream, and the formations of cyclic existence are like a prison, and like an illusion, a mirage, a reflection of the moon and water, and an echo."
An illusion, a mirage, an echo. You know, when practitioners first hear these metaphors, they sometimes mistake them for nihilism.
Yeah, that's a huge pitfall.
They think the Buddha is saying the world doesn't exist at all. But that is incorrect. Think about an echo. If you strike a bell, The echo certainly exists. You can hear it. But you cannot grab the echo and put it in a box. It has no solid core. The world appears vividly, but it lacks intrinsic, concrete reality.
I visualize this entire miraculous event as the Buddha essentially striking a cosmic tuning fork.
Oh, that's perfect.
He is taking the frequencies of emptiness, dependent origination, and the lack of a permanent self, and he is driving them directly into the bedrock of Khotan. He is programming the actual atmosphere to vibrate with ultimate truth.
And the Bodhisattva Manjushri recognizes the magnitude of this. He steps forward to ask the Buddha directly, for what purpose was this great miracle displayed? Like, why embed these complex teachings into the sky and the dirt?
And the Buddha's response reveals his profound foresight. He explains that because the environment itself has absorbed these truths, the future human beings who populate this land will not have to struggle endlessly to understand the Dharma.
The frequency of awakening will already be the baseline hum of their world.
He says they will purify their minds with very little effort. He even specifically prophesies that young children playing games in the dirt will naturally converse about these profound gateways of Dharma.
Because the dirt they are playing in has been blessed with the truth of emptiness.
Exactly.
The Buddha adds that if practitioners take shelter at Mount Goyuga, even malevolent forces and demons will be entirely unable to perceive them or inflict harm.
Why is that?
Because the practitioners' minds will become so completely resonant with the peaceful, empty nature of reality that they will simply fade from the view of ordinary afflicted beings.
That is just incredible. So at this point in the narrative, the spiritual foundation is flawless.
It is.
The space is protected by gods. It's anchored by future stupas, guarded by sacred statues, and physically humming with the teachings of emptiness and compassion. The pure potential of the lake has totally served its purpose.
But human beings are terrestrial.
Right. They cannot build a civilization on the water. The physical geography must now be reshaped to match the spiritual architecture.
Which brings us to the final phase of the Genesis, the physical draining of the lake. The Buddha commands two extraordinary figures from his retinue to execute this massive task.
He calls upon the great hearer Shariputra, universally recognized as the disciple foremost in wisdom, and the divine king Vairavanta, the embodiment of worldly power and protection.
The pairing of these two is so striking. You have the absolute pinnacle of monastic intellect paired with the brute force of a martial deity.
But before they act, the Buddha issues a strict parameter. He commands them to drain the lake and prepare the land without harming any beings living in the water. Even while executing a monumental feat of terraforming, the fundamental vow of nonviolence cannot be breached.
Compassion dictates the engineering here. Shariputra and Vaishravan fly miraculously to a nearby peak called Shah Mountain. Utilizing their immense spiritual power, Shariputra wields his simple monastic staff, and Vaishravan wields his divine spear.
And together they strike the mountain and cleave it entirely in two.
They physically lift the bisected halves of the mountain and move them westward.
By repositioning the mountain range, they create a massive natural diversion channel. The waters of the vast lake, along with every single fish, insect, and microscopic aquatic being, are safely and gently swept out of the valley and deposited into the Gisho River to the north.
Not a single life is lost in the making of the kingdom.
As the waters finally recede and the lake bed dries, the physical reality of the sutra is unveiled.
The stable foundation for the Gomasalaganda stupa finally appears.
The twin peaks of Mount Goshuga stand clearly above the newly formed fertile plains of the Khotan Valley. The pure potential has been safely converted into a habitable reality.
The stage is perfectly set for Prince Sukla of the Earthbreast to arrive a century later and build the land of virtue.
It is such a breathtaking conclusion to the prophetic narrative. But before we move into our final reflections on how to actually integrate this teaching into our daily lives, there is a fascinating historical footnote we should definitely address regarding the specific motif of the drained lake.
Oh, yes. The imagery of a sacred valley being formed by the miraculous draining of a vast lake is a deeply resonant mythic structure across the Himalayas.
Right.
Centuries later, as the specific historical location of ancient Khotan faded somewhat from the immediate memory of some Tibetan scholars, they encountered this sutra and attempted to map its geography onto a landscape they were, well, more familiar with.
Specifically, they mapped it onto the Kathmandu Valley in Nepal. And, you know, you can easily see how the confusion arose.
Totally.
Kathmandu has an established geological history of having once been a massive lake. It also features a highly prominent sacred hill on its western edge, topped by the revered Svayambhu Stupa.
The parallels to the lake, Mount Guhyuga, and the Gomasalaganda Stupa are completely undeniable.
So this misidentification became quite common until the brilliant 20th century Tibetan scholar and traveler Gendun Chopul rigorously analyzed the texts.
Mm-hmm. By comparing the specific directional markers, the names of the rivers, and the historical records within the sutra, he definitively clarifies for his contemporaries that the land of virtue described here is unquestionably the Central Asian kingdom of Khotan, not Nepal.
It really serves as a potent reminder of the importance of precise scholarly lineages in preserving the context of our sacred texts.
Absolutely.
So as we prepare to close this deep dive into the source material, let's synthesize the vast journey we've just undertaken. We have moved from a watery void of potential to a thriving civilization anchored by profound virtue. What are the essential insights a practitioner should carry forward from the prophecy on Mount Guhyuga?
I see three primary pillars of wisdom in this text. Mm. The first is the absolute undeniable interdependence of spiritual virtue and societal health. The sutra completely rejects the mundane view that security is derived from military or economic dominance. The true infrastructure of a civilization is the collective merit of its people, symbolized by the flourishing of the stupas. When ethical conduct and reverence decay, the society inevitably collapses inward.
And the second pillar is the profound objective power of blessings. The Buddha and his retinue did not merely preach ideas to the inhabitants of Khotan.
No, they didn't.
They fundamentally altered the energetic fabric of the environment itself. The text demands we recognize that physical space is not inert. It's a living canvas that actively absorbs and reflects the spiritual realizations or the profound ignorance of the beings who occupy it.
And the final pillar is the ultimate Mahayana synthesis of emptiness and compassion, which was just perfectly articulated through the miracle of the divine flowers.
Right.
The sutra insists that understanding emptiness, realizing that the ego is an illusion and reality is a transient echo, does not result in cold detachment.
That's so important.
Instead, it bursts forth as active, boundless compassion. It is the wisdom that knows the self is an illusion, combined with the compassion that will move a mountain to ensure a single fish isn't harmed.
So how then do we integrate this? Because we are not ancient citizens of Khotan, we do not expect a rain of divine flowers to fall outside our windows.
Well, the brilliance of the Mahayana is that every external teaching is simultaneously a map of the internal mind. You're the founder of your own internal land of virtue.
In meditation, our minds often resemble that initial chaotic lake, don't they?
Oh, completely. It is a vast expanse of unformed potential, totally turbulent and clouded with habitual afflictions.
By actively inviting the Dharma into our lives, by studying a text like this, by rigorously analyzing dependent origination, by sitting on the cushion, we are engaging in the work of Shariputra and Vaishravana.
Mm-hmm.
We are carefully, compassionately draining the lake of our ignorance and anger to reveal stable ground.
And once that ground is exposed, we must build our internal stupas. We erect unshakable monuments of mindfulness, loving kindness, and ethical discipline in the very center of our daily lives.
And just like the prophecy dictates, as long as we tend to those internal monuments, our personal land of virtue will prosper.
Yes.
If we neglect our practice and allow our inner stupas to fall into disrepair, our minds will be quickly overrun by the invading armies of anxiety, resentment, and despair.
It requires relentless vigilance. The protectors of Khotan vowed to defend the land only so long as the rulers governed with virtue.
Right.
We must act as the righteous sovereigns of our own consciousness, absolutely refusing to offer harbor or protection to negative afflicted mental states.
As we conclude this Dharma teaching, I want to leave you with one final, deeply provocative image from the text to contemplate. Near the end of the sutra, the Buddha makes an extraordinary claim about the lingering power of Khotan's blessing. He states that when hostile, faithless enemies from foreign lands invade Khotan, simply walking upon the sand and eating the food grown in that blessed dirt will spontaneously transform their minds. Their hatred will dissolve and they will be overcome with gentleness.
The environment itself becomes the ultimate agent of pacification. The blessing is so thick, it overpowers the karma of the invader.
So my question to you is this. What is the quality of the environment you are cultivating around yourself?
That's the real question.
If someone harboring deep anger, stress, or hostility walks into your home, your office, or simply sits beside you, does the space you occupy have the energetic gravity to calm them?
Have you saturated your own sand and food, your daily routines, your physical spaces, your immediate energetic footprint with enough mindfulness and compassion that it can actually transform the minds of those who cross your borders?
Are you building a sanctuary? The Buddha demonstrated that an awakened mind can overlay a sacred geography onto a barren wilderness. We all possess that exact same capacity to project a geography of peace over the ordinary, mundane spaces of our lives.
Because ultimately, as we noted at the very beginning, the conventional map of reality, the one defined by cold borders and objective materialism, is never the whole truth.
The true landscape of your life is the one you actively bless with your own realization. Thank you for offering your time, your spacious attention, and your ongoing dedication to the path. May the internal stupas you are building remain forever resilient.
May your practice continually flourish, and may the roots of virtue deepen in your own land of virtue.
Authentic Tibetan Teachings and Transcripts from BodhiArchive.org.